Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Ezekiel chapter 7, which I will entitle The Day of the Wrath of the Lord. More doom and gloom in this chapter. A little bit of introduction. This is a new and distinct prophecy from the last chapter. The timing of it is optionally either immediately upon the finish of the last prophecy in chapter 6 or maybe some indeterminate time between chapter 6 and chapter 8. Chapter 8 has a date. Ezekiel 8:1, we read, in the 6th year and the 6th month on the 5th day of the month. And that's referring to the 6th year of Jehoiachin's captivity, which was 597. That's the same year that Ezekiel went into captivity. That's when he's starting his dating from. So if Jehoiachin went into captivity in 597 and it's 6 years later, then roughly in 591 is when this prophecy is being given. Or I should say that's when the prophecy in chapter 8 is being given. And most probably the prophecy in Ezekiel 7 is right around the same time. So we're going to say around 591 B.C. is when this prophecy was given. So we begin now in verse 1 and we will read to verse 9. The word of the Lord came to me, son of man. This is what the sovereign Lord says to the land of Israel. The end. The end has come upon the four corners of the land. The end is now upon you, and I will unleash my anger against you. I will judge you according to your conduct and repay you for all your detestable practices. I will not look on you with pity or spare you. I will surely repay you for your conduct and the detestable practices among you. Then you will know that I am the Lord. This is what the sovereign Lord says. Disaster. An unheard of disaster is coming. The end has come. The end has come. That repetition is in verse 6. That's not me. It has roused itself against you. It has come. What has come? The end. Doom has come upon you, you who dwell in the land. The time has come. The day is near. There is panic, not joy, upon the mountains. I am about to pour out my wrath on you and spend my anger against you. I will judge you according to your conduct and repay you for all your detestable practices. I will not look on you with pity or spare you. I will repay you in accordance with your conduct and the detestable practices among you. Then you will know that it is I, the Lord, who strikes the blow. He mentions detestable practices, I can see, at least 3 times. He's talking about idolatry. This is a great screed against idolatry here in the first 9 verses. Now in verse 1, we read, the word of the Lord came to me, came to Ezekiel. And of course, this is a new distinct prophecy. Whenever he says that, the word of the Lord came to me, that's another prophecy. I've already said it's about 591. Verse 2, son of man, this is what the sovereign Lord says. What does son of man mean? 2 options. It could either be a title given to God, to Ezekiel, to keep him humble because he's just a man. Son of man means he has the characteristics of a man, which is finitude, weakness, or more probably, in my humble opinion, Ezekiel is a type of Jesus who called himself the Son of Man all the time. Jesus did that based on Daniel 7:14, where the Son of Man came up to the Ancient of Days. And so since the Son of Man was going to be the Messiah, and God knew that, he calls Ezekiel the Son of Man because Ezekiel is a type. He is a man preaching truth to the unbelieving house of Israel, even as Jesus the Messiah preached truth to the unbelieving house of Israel. Verse 2, son of man, this is what the sovereign Lord, notice this is the sovereign Lord. He is sovereign over all the idols that the Jews had recently been worshiping. The sovereign Lord says to the land of Israel, now Israel here, of course, refers to Judah and Benjamin, which is strictly speaking Judah, the northern 10 tribes of Israel, which many times in the Old Testament are referred to as Israel as opposed to Judah. That precise use of Israel is not being used here because the northern 10 tribes had been wiped out in 722 by the Assyrian Emperor Sargon II. So this is what God says to the people of Judah, the people of Israel, the end. Now, of course, that's not meaning the end of the world. It's the end of the Jewish world. It's the end of Jerusalem. That's what he's talking about because in just about 3 years, the Babylonians are going to come in 588 and begin a 30-month siege, which will eventuate in the destruction of Jerusalem in 586. The end has come upon the four corners of the land. That means not just Jerusalem, but all over Eretz, the land of Israel. Now, that word Eretz can be translated earth, as I've often pointed out going through these podcasts, but that's obviously not what's being referred to here. It's talking about the land of Israel is about to be wiped out by the Babylonians. Verse 3, the end is now upon you. Notice how often he repeats the end. The end in verse 1. Verse 3, the end. Verse 6, the end has come. Once. Verse 6, the end has come. Again. So we get the idea here. The end has come. It reminds me of these people walking around with sackcloth and long hair in modern day America with their signs, the end is near. They've become a meme, a joke. This was no joke, folks. The end was coming. And of course, the end was perfectly just. God is going to judge the Jews because of their conduct, their detestable practices, which is mentioned three times that I can look at right here. The detestable practices being their idolatry. And then when the end comes at the end of verse 4, then you will know that I am the Lord. Now this shows the purpose of this judgment is to teach them who God is. This is repeated three times in this chapter and once in the previous chapter. So let me read you the three additional verses in addition to Ezekiel 7:4, where we are now. Ezekiel 6:7 in the previous chapter. The slain will fall among you, and you will know that I am Yahweh. This chapter, 5 verses later in Ezekiel 7:9. I will not look on you with pity or spare you. I will punish you for your ways and for your detestable practices within you. Then you will know that it is I, Yahweh, who strikes. And then in the very last verse of this chapter, Ezekiel 7:27, the king will mourn, the prince will be clothed in grief, and the hands of the people of the land will tremble. I will deal with them according to their own conduct, and I will judge them by their own standards. Then they will know that I am Yahweh. I'm going to finish up this podcast when I get to verse 27 by repeating these four verses again so that we will get the idea here why it is that God judges his people, so we will know who he is, because we are so stupid and idolatrous and blind that we do not see God, who has put evidence of his existence everywhere, not only in natural revelation, look at the stars, but also in special revelation, read the Bible. Verse 5 in Ezekiel 7, we continue, this is what the sovereign Lord says, disaster. Notice how Ezekiel always calls God the sovereign Lord. An unheard of disaster is coming. Well, that's true. The destruction of Jerusalem is pretty much unheard of. It's one of the biggest events in Jewish history. In fact, in the history of the ancient Near East, we don't often hear of big cities getting wiped out like this. Verse 6, he repeats, the end has come. The end has come twice for rhetorical effect. It, the end, has roused itself against you. It, the end, has come. So basically he says it three times here in verse 6. Verse 7, doom has come upon you. So we have disaster, the end, doom. You who dwell in the land, that's the land of Israel. The time has come, the day is near. Well, we've already said this prophecy was given in 591 or thereabouts. 586 is not too far off, 5 years. And in fact, the siege began 3 years later in 588. So the day was near. There is panic, not joy, upon the mountains. This could be a reference to the joyous festivities going on up on the hills where the idolatrous shrines were. Verse 8, God says, I'm about to pour out my wrath on you. And again, 3 years is coming, the siege is coming, the hunger is going to begin, and the killing with the sword when the Babylonians break through the walls in 586, that's about to happen too. I'm about to pour out my wrath on you and spend my anger against you. I will judge you according to your conduct. Notice that this is not arbitrary wrath that God is pouring out on the Israelites. It is condign wrath. He is judging them according to their conduct. He's repaying them for their detestable practices. Verse 9, I will not look on you with pity or spare you. Now, God is a God of mercy, of course, but not when you filled up the cup of his wrath to the tip top like the Israelites had done, like the people of Judah had done. In verse 9, I will repay you in accordance with your conduct and with the detestable practices among you. Again, those detestable practices are idolatry, as other practices too, actually. Judicial injustice, cheating the poor, cheating the widow, hurting the orphan, typical things that the Israelites were always doing. Verse 9. Then you will know that it is I, the Lord, who strikes the blow. Again, once you get judged, you're going to know who's boss. You're going to know it. We go now to Ezekiel 7, verses 10 through 13. God continues, the day is here. Now, that's the day of God's wrath. Notice that judgment day here is 586 BC, not the end of the world. The idea of the day of the wrath of the Lord is such that it is ubiquitous, actually. When God judges, it's called the day of God's wrath. It's not necessarily the end of the world, the final day of wrath. The day is here, it has come. Doom has burst forth. The rod has budded. Arrogance has blossomed. Violence has grown into a rod to punish wickedness. None of the people would be left. None of that crowd. No wealth, nothing of value. The time has come. The day has arrived. Let not the buyer rejoice, nor the seller grieve, for wrath is upon the whole crowd. The seller will not recover the land he has sold as long as both of them live, for the vision concerning the whole crowd will not be reversed. Because of their sins, not one of them will preserve his life. In verse 10, God is saying that the day is here, that's Judgment Day on Jerusalem, the 10th of Av, 586. It has come. Of course, it hasn't come yet, literally, but it means actually, as a matter of fact, it might as well be here. It has come. Doom is burst forth. The rod is budded. That rod would be Nebuchadnezzar. He's ready to come. Three more years in 588, he'll be at the walls. Arrogance has blossomed. That could be Nebuchadnezzar's arrogance, but I believe rather that it's Israel or Judah's arrogance that has blossomed. But that arrogance is about to get cut short. Verse 11, violence has grown into a rod. That could be Nebuchadnezzar has grown into a rod. We've already said that the rod is budded in verse 10. So verse 11, violence has grown into a rod. It sounds like Nebuchadnezzar. It could be Israel. Its violence has grown into a rod so that the rod that Israel is producing, i.e. the Babylonians, is going to punish the Israelites' wickedness. I don't think so. I think it's Nebuchadnezzar. The violence of his army has grown into a rod. None of the people will be left, none of that crowd. All the nobles were carried off into captivity in 586. That doesn't mean that everybody was carried off into captivity, but it means all the big shots were carried off into captivity to Babylon in 586. None of that crowd, no wealth, nothing of value. They've got nothing left. They have been expropriated. Verse 12, the time has come, the day has arrived. Once again, that day, the day of judgment, common metaphor for a time of judgment. Let not the buyer rejoice, nor the seller grieve. Now, why would a buyer rejoice? Well, usually when a buyer buys a piece of land, he rejoices because he has added lands to his estate. But why should that make him happy if he buys land at this time? Because the Babylonians are just going to come take it away from him. So he shouldn't be happy about having extra land, nor should the seller grieve. Typically, a seller would grieve because he has to sell part of his estate to pay his debts. What difference does that make? Why does it matter that the seller has lost some of his land to pay his debts? He's going to lose all of his land anyway. Debts and ownership of land only make sense in a civil, legally organized society, which is going to disappear in 586. Why should the buyer and seller not have any emotions about this? Why should the buyer not rejoice and the seller not grieve? For wrath is upon the whole crowd. That's the way the NIV has it, the whole crowd. I'm assuming that's talking about the nobles, the big shots at the top of Jewish society. Verse 13, the seller will not recover the land he has sold as long as both of them live. Now, what's that referring to? It's referring to the year of Jubilee. As Benson, Ellicott, Kyle, and Delitzsch all say, here is the relevant scripture in the law, Leviticus 25, verses 27 through 28. He, that's the seller, may repay the balance to the man he sold it to, that's the buyer, and return to his property. But if he cannot obtain enough to repay him, what he sold will remain in the possession of its purchaser until the year of Jubilee. It is to be released at the Jubilee so that he, that's the seller, may return to his property. Now, this is a little complicated legally. Basically, when an Israelite sold land, he didn't sell it like we do in fee simple so that the title to the land goes to the buyer. Basically, what the buyer had was a term of years, and the term of years that he had depended upon how close the sale was to the year of Jubilee, and the length of the term of years depended upon how close the sale was to the year of Jubilee. If there were 47 years to the year of Jubilee, the purchaser could keep the land for 47 years, and then he would have to give it back. If the sale of the land was 8 years before the year of Jubilee, then after 8 years, the purchaser will have to give it back. So basically what's happening here is the purchaser is a lender, a creditor who, quote unquote, lends the money with the purchase price to the buyer, and the buyer has the use of that money. Now, the buyer's going to want to get his land back. He gets his land back when he pays off the quote unquote loan back to the quote unquote purchaser. That's what Leviticus 25:27 says here. He, that's the seller, may repay the balance to the man he sold it to. Basically, his creditor, he can pay off his loan. We would put it in modern terms. And when he does that, he gets his property back. He can return to his property. But what happens if the seller never comes up with enough money to pay off the balance that he owes on the purchase price of the land? Or to put it in our terms, the balance of the loan. Verse 28, Leviticus 25. But if he, that's the seller, cannot obtain enough money to repay the purchaser, the lender, what he sold will remain in the possession of the purchaser, the lender, until the year of Jubilee. And then the creditor, the lender, the purchaser of the land has to give the land back to the seller of the land, the borrower of the money, with the land being the collateral. Now you might think, well, what happens if there's only 2 years to the year of Jubilee? Why would anybody buy land? Well, the price would be discounted accordingly. That would be a market function between the buyer and the seller, because no purchaser, i.e. lender, is going to buy property, i.e. lend money on property, if he's got to give his collateral up in 2 years. So he's going to either not lend at all, or he's only going to lend a little bit. Well, all of that fancy financial and legal stuff's not going to be going on. In 586, verse 13 of Ezekiel 7 says, the seller will not recover the land he has sold. In other words, when the year of Jubilee comes, the seller of the land's not going to get his land back. Now, if you think about it, the captivity lasted, or I should say the ascendancy of Babylon, let's put it that way, lasted for 70 years. Jeremiah's famous 70 years from 609 to 539. We're now at 586. That's 23 out of the 70 years. That leaves 47 years. Year of Jubilee is every 49 years. So the odds are that a year of Jubilee is going to pass while they are in captivity. But even so, doesn't matter. Saul's not going to get his land back, because the Babylonians are going to own the land. Verse 13, the vision concerning the whole crowd, that's the whole crowd of nobles in Jerusalem. The vision, Ezekiel's vision of doom and gloom and end and destruction and disaster, it's not going to be reversed. At the end of verse 13, in the NIV translation, we have a little problem. Because of their sins, not one of them will preserve his life. Well, that sounds like that everybody in Jerusalem was wiped out in 586. That did not happen, of course. So how do we solve this problem? Well, the first answer is, a first possible way to solve it, is to say that the not one of them is referring to this hypothetical seller and buyer. Not one of them will preserve his life. The seller's not going to get his land back. The buyer's not going to rejoice over buying the land. Not one of them, not a buyer, not a seller, a hypothetical buyer or seller, is going to make it. They're going to die. Well, I think that's quite reasonable, but we also need to point out that there's a translation problem here, and that might be the way to solve it. So let's look at some other translations. Ezekiel 7:13 in the American Standard Version. For the seller shall not return to that which is sold, although they be yet alive. That means the buyer and the seller, though they be yet alive. For the vision is touching the whole multitude thereof. None shall return, neither shall any strengthen himself in the iniquity of his life. Nobody's going to return to the land he sold in the year of Jubilee. That's what that means. And then, neither shall any strengthen himself in the iniquity of his life. Well, that doesn't say that neither shall any survive. That just says that no one will be strong in his sin, because everything's going to be wiped out. Doesn't say that every sinner will be killed. It just means that no sinner will be able to strengthen his sin, if you will. That's the ESV. Well, let's look at the Bible in basic English. For the trader will not go back to the things for which he had his price, even while he is still living. They just leave out the rest of the verse that says none shall return. So there might be a textual problem there, which I don't have the time or energy or inclination to investigate. We look at the Darby translation, Ezekiel 7:13. For the seller shall not return to that which is sold, even though he were yet alive amongst the living. For the vision is touching the whole multitude thereof. It shall not be revoked, and none shall through his iniquity assure his life. In other words, nobody's going to be confident that he will live. It doesn't say that nobody will live. It's just that nobody will assure his life to be sure that he's going to live. That's the Darby translation. Here's the Young's literal translation. For the seller to the sold thing turneth not, and yet among the living is their life. For the vision is unto all its multitude. It doth not turn back, and none by his iniquity doth strengthen his life. In other words, sinners are not going to put themselves in a more advantageous position by his iniquity. That gets rid of the problem just by translating it differently. I don't understand why the NIV, the Holman Christian Study Bible, and other translations translate it that way. Not one of them will preserve his life. It sure is misleading, in my humble opinion, because obviously some people survive the siege. Jeremiah survived it, unless those translators assume that it's referring to the buyer and the seller. They're not going to preserve their life. Not one of them, not one of the buyer or seller will preserve his life. I suspect that's what they're thinking. We go down to Ezekiel 7, verses 14 through 19. Though they blow the trumpet and get everything ready, no one will go into battle. For my wrath is upon the whole crowd. Outside is the sword, inside are plague and famine. Those in the country will die by the sword, and those in the city will be devoured by famine and plague. All who survive and escape will be in the mountains, moaning like doves of the valleys, each because of his sins. Every hand will go limp, and every knee will become as weak as water. They will put on sackcloth and be clothed with terror. Their faces will be covered with shame, and their heads will be shaved. They will throw their silver into the streets, and their gold will be an unclean thing. Their silver and gold will not be able to save them in the day of the Lord's wrath. They will not satisfy their hunger or fill their stomachs with it, for it has made them stumble into sin. In verse 14, God says that they, that is the Jewish leaders, will blow the trumpet. Jews will blow trumpets upon the approach of an enemy for a warning. And so they blow the trumpet and get everything ready to resist, but nobody will go into battle. Probably too hungry. Probably too overmatched by the Babylonian army. Wrath is upon the whole crowd being the Jewish nobles and leaders and princes. Verse 15, outside is the sword. If you leave the city walls, the Babylonian army will cut you down. But if you stay inside the protection of those walls, protected from the Babylonian swords, you have to face plague and famine. Those two things go together. Those two things go together often in sieges. People get hungry, then they get sick. Those in the country will die by the sword, and those in the city will be devoured by famine and plague, which is just a repetition of the first part of the verse. Verse 16, all who survive and escape will be in the mountains. If you have to hide in the mountains from the Babylonians, that's a miserable and uncomfortable life. People hiding in the mountains will moan like doves. When doves coo, they sound like they're mourning. And each person who survives and escape, in other words, he might survive the swords outside the city, and he might survive the plague and the famine inside the city. He does that by leaving the city, escaping the Babylonian army which has surrounded the city, escaping to the mountains with no money, probably no family, with no job, with no food. It's because of his sins, as God says at the end of verse 16. 17, every hand will go limp. You're so weak from hunger you can't hold a weapon to defend yourself, so your hands are limp. Every knee will become as weak as water. That happens when you get hungry. Your knees start wobbling. You can't even stand up. Verse 18, they, that's the subjects of the siege, the Jews, will put on sackcloth. That's a typical expression of mourning, of course. They will be clothed with terror. Their faces will be covered with shame, and their heads will be shaved. Now, the shaving of the head was not done because of mourning. To make your head bald as a token of mourning for the dead was actually forbidden the Jews. We read that in Deuteronomy 14:1. You are sons of the Lord your God. Do not cut yourselves or make a bald spot on your head on behalf of the dead. Well, if you can't shave your head for a funeral practice, I wonder if it's all right to shave your head as an expression of mourning. I'm not sure that whatever commentator I read that said that made that distinction. One commentator said the heads would be shaved because of the plucking out of the hair because of distress. They just rip the hair out of their skulls. because they're so miserable. In verse 19, they will throw their silver into the streets and their gold will be an unclean thing. And that means if it's unclean, they're going to get rid of it. Why? Because how do you run burdened down with gold and silver? Gold and silver is extremely heavy. How do you run to those mountains? How do you avoid the Babylonian army who would love to kill you in order to get that gold? Silver and gold will not be able to save them in the day of the Lord's wrath. Are they going to buy protection from the Babylonians? No, the Babylonian army will just steal the silver and gold. The silver and gold will not satisfy the Jews' hunger or fill their stomachs with food, because the Jews cannot satisfy their hunger by filling their stomachs with gold, because you can't eat silver and gold. And silver and gold is no good if there's no food to buy, and there was no food to buy during the famine. We go now to Ezekiel 7, verses 20 through 24. They were proud of their beautiful jewelry and used it to make their detestable idols and vile images. Therefore I will turn these into an unclean thing for them. I will hand it all over as plunder to foreigners and as loot to the wicked of the earth, and they will defile it. I will turn my face away from them, and they will desecrate my treasured place. Robbers will enter it and desecrate it. Prepare chains, because the land is full of bloodshed and the city is full of violence. I will bring the most wicked of the nations to take possession of their houses. I will put an end to the pride of the mighty, and their sanctuaries will be desecrated. Now in verse 20 we have a translation issue. The NIV version says they were proud of their beautiful jewelry, and other translations do that too, but you can translate that verse in such a way that it is the temple that is being referred to. For example, let me read from the American Standard Version. As for the beauty of his ornament, he set it in majesty. The his there would be God instead of their beautiful jewelry. It's his ornament, God's ornament, meaning the temple. He, that's God, set it in majesty. But they made the images of their abominations and their detestable things therein. In other words, they put the idols in the temple. Therefore have I made it, the temple, unto them as an unclean thing. Well, that works pretty good. And remember, idols were actually set up in the temple right there under Manasseh, who ruled from 687 to 642. Here's another translation in the Bible in basic English. As for their beautiful ornament, they had put it on high and had made the images of their disgusted and hated things in it. So the beautiful ornament would be the temple. They had put it on high. They had exalted it. They had made the images of their disgusted and hated things and put them in that temple. The Darby translation, the King James translation, and the Young's Literal translation also translates that phrase as their beautiful ornament or his beautiful ornament. It's either God's temple or the Jews' temple, depending on whether the pronoun is his or their. However, I must say that the context seems to favor this view. We read in verse 22 from the NIV, they will desecrate my treasured place. Robbers will enter it and desecrate it. Now, that's obviously referring to the temple, as even the NIV translation shows. And so, on the NIV's translation, we have to switch from beautiful jewelry in verse 20 to the temple in verse 22. But if you just take the ornament as being the temple, you don't have to make such a switch. So, I think from context, I prefer the view that it's the temple that God is going to turn into an unclean thing, i.e. by burning it down. I will hand it, the temple, over to the foreigners, and I will loot the temple and turn it over as loot to the wicked of the earth, to the Babylonians, and they, the Babylonians, will defile it when they enter it and burn it down. That flows right into verse 22. I will turn my face away from them, and they will desecrate my treasured place. The context works pretty good there. Now, if we want to take the translation as jewelry instead of ornament, they were proud of their beautiful jewelry. That just means that they would take the jewelry of the women of Israel, the gold and silver, melt it down, and then use it to make idols. And then, at the end of verse 20, God will turn these pieces of jewelry into an unclean thing, into an idol. And then, God is going to hand all that jewelry over as plunder to foreigners, as the foreigners take the jewelry. Now, that doesn't mean the foreigners will take the idols, which the jewelry has been made into, but I think it's referring to the jewelry that hasn't been melted down yet. And the Babylonians would take it as loot, and they will defile it. I don't know how that would be, except by themselves melting it down and making idols with it. I just think it's easier to say it's the temple instead of jewelry. It can go either way. I'll report it. You decide. We have another translation issue in verse 20. God says he's going to take that jewelry or that temple and turn it into an unclean thing. The King James doesn't have turn it into an unclean thing. The King James says, therefore, I have set it far from them. In other words, the temple is a long, long way off. Or if it's the jewelry is a long, long way off. Or if it's the jewelry which has already been made into idols, then the idols are a long, long way off, because the Jews are all the way over in Babylon, having been captured in captivity and taken over there. The King James has it that way. I have set it far from them. I had one other translation that did that. I think that's off the wall. We're going to assume that it's, I will turn these into an unclean thing for them. These pieces of jewelry, these idols, this temple, whatever, whichever way you choose to interpret that. All right, so much for verse 20. Verse 21, I will hand it all over as plunder to foreigners. The foreigners, of course, are the Babylonians, and as loot to the wicked of the earth, and they will defile it. Verse 22, I will turn my face away from them. Now, that could be the Jews. I will turn my face away from the Jews, but he's talking about the foreigners, the Babylonians here. So the context seems to me to say that God will turn his face away from the Babylonians, which would mean that God will cease from looking at them in order to restrain them. He's going to say, okay, I don't see what you're doing, Babylonians. I can't see all that bloodshed and rapine that you're doing to the Jews, so go ahead and get at it. I will turn my face away from them, away from the Babylonians, and they, the Babylonians, will desecrate my treasured place. Robbers will enter it and desecrate it. That happened in 586. Verse 23, prepare chains. Chains for the Jews who are being taken into captivity. Prepare chains. Why? Because the land is full of bloodshed and the city is full of violence. What kind of violence? John Gill says it was rapine, oppression, and injury done to the poor, the widow, and the fatherless. So in other words, God's judgment is perfectly just. Verse 24, God says, I will bring the most wicked of the nations to take possession of their houses. Why is Babylon called the most wicked of the nations? Well, the Babylonians were notorious for their cruelty, their savageness, their barbarity. God says at the end of verse 24, I will put an end to the pride of the mighty. That's the leaders of the Jewish people in Jerusalem. And their sanctuaries will be desecrated. Now we have a problem here. Why is sanctuaries plural? Sanctuaries can be translated as holy places. That's what a sanctuary is. It's a place that's holy, that's separate, dedicated to a god, separate from normal profane use. Now, here are some options as to why here the word is plural. Option number one, sanctuaries in the plural refers to the holy place and the Holy of Holies. Two sanctuaries in the temple? I don't think so. Here's option number two, Joseph Benson, is referring to the temple and all its courts. The temple was a holy place and the courts were holy. I don't think that's true either. I think the best option is this is not referring to God's holy place at all. It's referring to pagan sanctuaries, self-constituted holy places, if you will. As the pulpit commentator says, the idolatrous sanctuaries the Israelites had built. I think that makes a lot of sense. They're going to be destroyed as the Babylonians come in. We go now to verses 25 through 27 of Ezekiel 7, and we will be finished with this chapter. When terror comes, they will seek peace, but there will be none. Calamity upon calamity will come, and rumor upon rumor. They will try to get a vision from the prophet. They, there's the people of Jerusalem. The teaching of the law by the priest will be lost, as will the counsel of the elders. The king will mourn, the prince will be clothed with despair, and the hands of the people of the land will tremble. I will deal with them according to their conduct, and by their own standards I will judge them. Then they will know that I am the Lord. So in verse 25, the people of Jerusalem will seek peace. They will try to negotiate with Babylon, but they will not be negotiating from a position of strength. And so their negotiations will be to no avail. There will be no peace, as verse 25 concludes. Verse 26, instead, calamity upon calamity will come and rumor upon rumor. As John Gill describes this, the Chaldean army, that's the Babylonian army, is in such a place, and then that it is in another place still nearer, and then that it is but a few miles off and will be here immediately. Rumor upon rumor. Hey, the Babylonians are coming. Did you hear they're there? Oh, the Babylonians are coming. Did you hear they're even closer? They, that's the people of Jerusalem, the leaders of Jerusalem, will try to get a vision from the prophet. Probably a favorable vision. They had Jeremiah. They didn't listen to him. They will try to get a vision from the prophet. The teaching of the law by the priest. That's what the priest did. They taught the law. Oh, what does the law say about this? Well, they haven't paid attention to prophets and priests for so long, but they get themselves in a crack. They experience a little foxhole religion, and they start running back to the people of God, or people who claim to be people of God. They'll also go running back to the council of the elders. Now, vision, teaching, and counsel, that's a good summary of what was necessary to keep the Old Testament house of God functioning. And it's also a good object lesson as to what is necessary to keep the New Testament church functioning. Somebody's got to have vision. They've got to be led by the Holy Spirit instead of dead Protestant ritual. Three songs and a sermon. Starts at 11 o'clock, ends at 12 or 12:15, and the sermon's got to be 20 minutes long. And, oh, we'll recite the Apostles' Creed in here somewhere, and we'll do the same thing every week for an eternity. No, you need people who can hear from God as to which land do you want this church to take? Which stronghold do you want this church to attack? And the teaching of the law, that's the scripture. What does the scripture say? It is distressing how little Christians know what the scripture is. That's why I'm doing this podcast, to try to help with that. But I get discouraged about it a lot. I get discouraged about how little I know. The teaching of the law by the priest will be lost, as will the counsel of the elders. Do people listen to the wise counsel of the spiritually mature in their church? Well, they should. Verse 27, the king will mourn, the prince will be clothed with despair. That's the same person. That's Zedekiah. Three bad things happened to Zedekiah, who, by the way, ruled from 597 to 586. First bad thing that happened to him, his children were killed in front of his own eyes by Nebuchadnezzar at Riblah. And then, after he got to see that bloody event, Zedekiah was blinded. That's the second bad thing that happened to him. And the third bad thing that happened to him, he was carried into captivity where he died an ignominious death. Verse 27, yes, the king will mourn. He will be clothed with despair. Absolutely. Ezekiel's prophecy was fulfilled. And the hands of the people of the land will tremble. That's because they're weak, they're hungry, they're frightened. I will deal with them according to their conduct again. The judgment is just. It's not arbitrary. They did it. They deserve it. And by their own standards, I will judge them. What standards? Well, the Jews had the Torah. They had the law. And God says, okay, I'm going to take the law and judge them. They say they keep the law. They're people of the book. They're proud Jews, but they don't pay any attention to it. So I'm going to take the law, and I'm going to judge the Jews by what's written in their own law, their own standards. That would be in Deuteronomy 27 and 28, the curses of the law, and I think it's Leviticus 26, if I remember correctly, those famous curses that were read by the priest from Mount Ebal over Shechem, over the valley that Shechem was in. By their own standards, they should have practiced what they preached. The Jews in Jerusalem should have done that. They didn't do it. But after God has dealt with them according to their own conduct, then they will know that I am the Lord. Now, I've already mentioned earlier in this session that Ezekiel really mentions a good many times that God's judgment is for the purpose that people will know who he is. I'm going to finish off this session by reading you four verses in chapter 6 and 7 of Ezekiel that emphasize that point. Ezekiel 6, 7, the slain will fall among you, and you will know that I am Yahweh. Ezekiel 7, 4, I will not look on you with pity or spare you, but I will punish you for your ways and for your detestable practices within you. Then you will know that I am Yahweh. Ezekiel 7, 9, I will not look on you with pity or spare you. I will punish you for your ways and for your detestable practices within you. Then you will know that it is I, Yahweh, who strikes. Ezekiel 7, 27, that's the verse we just read. I'm going to read it again. The king will mourn, the prince will be clothed in grief, and the hands of the people of the land will tremble. I will deal with them according to their own conduct, and I will judge them by their own standards. Then they will know that I am Yahweh. So the application point here is you can get to know God as a friend, or you can get to know him as a punisher, as an upholder of his righteousness. You got a choice. And I will tell you, those of us, those Christians who have decided to rebel at some point in their life, they will tell you. It is a terrible thing to fall into the hands of a living God. Now, God is just and loving, and he redeems, and he gets us out of dealing with him as an angry lawgiver, but more as a loving father. He'll teach you that. But when you're not listening and you don't know who God is, things can get really, really toasty. Things can get really, really uncomfortable. Ladies and gentlemen, with that little word of admonishment, we have now finished Ezekiel 7. We are now prepared to go in our next audio to Ezekiel 8, which I will entitle Abominations in the Temple. I hope you stay tuned for that, and I hope you enjoyed this audio.